When it comes to establishing divine authority, where do we start?
Bible.
Well, that's right. That's a good place to start. But the Bible teaches us, as far as communicating God's will, how? How do we learn what He says? Pardon me? All right, what's that help us to know? All right, very good. So we see direct statements, approved examples, and necessary inference. That's where we start. That's how God communicates with us. That's how we communicate with each other. That's just a standard beginning place of communication. And, of course, then once we've established what God has communicated, then we've got a choice to make. The choice is that general or is it very specific? Now, if it's general, then generic authorities, we sometimes refer to it, includes, for example, when God told Noah to build an ark. Build an ark. Now, we might say, well, that's specific in what he was to build. It didn't say build a barn. He was to build an ark. But the building of an ark necessitates certain tools. God told him what size to make it. Now, in telling him what size to make it, would that not include some kind of measuring device so he could make it that long, that high? Well, surely. And so we see that in build an ark, what's included in that? Anything necessary to the building of an ark? Tools and so forth. Did God specify the tools? No. That's included generically or generally when he said build an ark. But we do also notice in that illustration that God told Noah not only to build an ark, but he told him to build it out of gopher wood. Now, could he reason and argue that about any kind of wood would work as long as he used some gopher wood? No, that was specific. God specified the kind of wood. Now, if he had varied on the kind of wood, then he would not have been obeying God. But we notice in Hebrews chapter 11, beginning about verse 7 and 8, we find that Noah prepared an ark. Why? By faith. He moved with godly fear and prepared an ark. Now, in our studies, we've examined some folks that didn't do that. We've talked about Nadab and Abihu, how that they offered a strange fire, which he had commanded them not, or which he had not commanded them. God was silent about the fire that they used, but he had spoken about what fire to use. And when they deviated from that, they acted upon their own, and the judgment of God was death. We've talked about Saul and the Amalekites, how that God instructed Saul to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Now, Saul reasoned and rationalized, but the bottom line of what Saul had done was he had disobeyed God. His act is referred to by Samuel as stubbornness. He disobeyed God. Now the point being, Samuel said to Saul, "Hath God as much delight in sacrifice and offering as in obeying?" Well, no. Who had told Saul to offer a sacrifice? No one. He acted on his own. Well, Saul did. Yeah, he acted on his own. He presumed or acted presumptuously that that would be just as good as what God said. David?
Well, God had commanded sacrifice of people instead of the leaders. So they brought this stuff back to offer sacrifice. But if you obey, you're going to do what God said, and you're still going to sacrifice.
Sure you are.
And he told you, so you've got everything covered.
Yeah. But Saul kind of added too.
Well, he's breaking the rules. So
yeah. That don't work, and that got him into trouble. And again, God's judgment was, Saul, you have rebelled, and so consequently, I will reject you as being king. Now, here's one we want to particularly notice. We have talked about this in brief, but I want to talk about it in a little bit more detail. In Hebrews chapter 7, I want to begin reading at verse 11, Hebrews chapter 7. In Hebrews chapter 7, verse 11, it says, "Now if there was perfection through the Levitical priesthood, for under it hath the people received the law." I don't know if some of you are reading from a translation that says, "if there was completion." Do you have something that indicates that? The idea of being perfect in this passage has to do with being complete, being made whole. And it says, "Through the Levitical priesthood, for under it had the people received the law." What further need was there that another priest should arise after the order of Melchizedek and not be reckoned after the order of Aaron? Do you see his question? If that Levitical priesthood was sufficient, the one that came down from the descent of Aaron, then why would there be a necessity of a change in the priesthood? And instead of a priesthood after the order of Aaron, there would be one after the order of Melchizedek. Now you remember it was a matter of Old Testament prophecy, wasn't it? That God spoke through David the prophet in Psalms 110 and said there was going to be a new priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. Now when we talk about after the order of Melchizedek, we might want to think just a little bit about what that meant. Melchizedek was an Old Testament king and priest that we know very little about. You can read about a little bit about him in Genesis chapter 14. And in that text, we learn that Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. The Hebrew writer makes reference to that to indicate that through Abraham, the whole Jewish nation had paid tithes to Melchizedek. And he points out that the lesser pays tithes to the greater instead of the other way around. What does that tell us about Melchizedek? He was greater than Abraham. And if he was greater than Abraham, then he was greater than any priesthood that was a part of the Israelite nation that had descended from Abraham. Now that becomes significant to us. And so in this passage, he refers to the prophecies regarding the establishment of a new priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. Now, if the old priesthood was good enough, why have a new one? Isn't that his question? Well, let's read verse 12. He said, "For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law." Now, why is that so? Well, he says at verse 13, "For he of whom these things are said belongeth to another tribe, from which no man hath given attendance at the altar." Why not? Why didn't anybody serve as a priest from another tribe, such as the tribe of Judah or the tribe of Issachar? Well, God had spoken regarding the priesthood. And God's will was, Randy, that the Levites, those descending from Aaron, that these be the priests. David?
Well, you have that priesthood you had in Melchizedek. Counting blood here, it was a complete, rather than the Jews being incomplete, Melchizedek priesthood was complete.
Yes, and it was unique. Talk to us a little about that.
And so you had this priesthood that Abraham paid tithes to, showing that it was acceptable by God. We can use unnecessary.
All right, that's true.
Of course, he kind of uses it here. But when the law came about, he had to have a priesthood for it. The law was given to bring the people of Israel's sins before them. So your priesthood for that law complete.
All right, that's right. No, they had to offer sacrifices for themselves and then for the sins of the people, and that was one of the things that indicated the imperfection of it. One other comment perhaps we should make about the priesthood descending from Abraham. Remember that Abraham was to be the father of many nations. There wasn't any such thing as a nation of Israel at the time of Abraham. Wasn't any such thing as a Jew at the time of Abraham. He was back before all of that. He was the beginning of all of that. And so after that, the Apostle Paul, writing in the Galatian letter, tells us that it was about 430 years after that, we have the giving of the law of Moses. So that puts it on a timeline for you. And the law of Moses specified the kind of priesthood that was to exist, and that was those who had descended from the tribe of Levi. David?
Change and mind you are a priest forever. Melchizedek, referring to the Melchizedek priesthood would be revived, or there would be somebody coming in the order of Melchizedek.
Be like him.
Right, and this was given in the middle of the Jewish priesthood.
Yeah.
That was David, so that would be about middle way through the Jewish nation of the Jewish priesthood. So they should have known that, hey, this is not going on forever, but it's going to change
Well, they ought to have known a lot of things by that time that they didn't, but that's true. One comment about Melchizedek, we learn in the book of Hebrews, and I believe the Old Testament text of Genesis 14 mentions this, that he was king of Salem, and he was also priest. Now, that was very unique, because in the nation of Israel, they had a lineage, supposed to be, a lineage of those who were kings, and a different lineage of those who were priests. So the two didn't mix. You've got two different lineages. The seed of David was to be the lineage of the kings. And up here then you've got the lineage of Levi that was to be the lineage of priest. Now, the mixing of those to have one who is both king and priest, like Melchizedek was at the time of Abraham, was unique. And so from that standpoint, we want to notice this. If Christ is to be priest, then he was also to be king in order to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. He would serve in two offices. Now, going back to the text of Hebrews chapter 7, it says in verse 12 again, "For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law." You see, the law stipulated the priesthood of the tribe of Levi. Christ can't be priest according to the law. Why not? Verse 13, "For he of whom these things are said belongeth to another tribe, from which no man hath given attendance at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord has sprung out of the tribe of Judah, as to which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priest." And we want to observe that. The very point in the argument that the Hebrew writer is making is that you can't establish a new priesthood on the basis of God's silence. God said nothing about priests from Judah. Then what does that say even about Jesus serving as priest under the law? Could he do that? No. God was silent. Didn't say anything about priests from the tribe of Judah. What do we learn from that? God's silence has to be respected, because over here he didn't say anything. Over here he spoke. How can you know what God's will is on any subject? Could the Jews have known the lineage through which priests were to be established if God was silent on both counts? Could they? No. The only way they could know what God said is when God spoke. But here the Hebrew writer says that concerning priests from Judah, God didn't speak on that. So how can you establish a priesthood that would even include the Son of God when he's not from the priestly tribe? You can't reason and say, well, God didn't say not to, because he addressed that over here. He spoke. But Paul, or the Hebrew writer's argument is, even the Lord can't be priest under this Old Testament system, because God was silent about priests from the tribe of Judah. Now that makes note that we must respect when God is silent on something. We can't presume to act. God's judgment was that priests could only be from the tribe of Levi. Now, David, we've talked about that. You introduced it from Acts the 15th chapter. And we want to notice that authority was established regarding the will of God in circumcising the Gentiles. That we don't circumcise Gentiles. Peter said, by my example, we don't do that. Paul and Barnabas said, here are the miracles that God wrought through us, and we didn't teach that. So the conclusion that's essential is, God didn't tell us to do that. If he had, then we couldn't have performed miracles. And then to that, James said, well, that's exactly what Amos said. And he quoted the Old Testament text. But verse 24 tells us that regarding this teaching, the apostles said, these went out, and we didn't say anything to them about teaching that. Now, what does that tell us? These were acting upon the premise, well, you didn't say not to. So they were appealing to their own authority, not God's. They couldn't argue on the basis of silence and say, well, you didn't say nothing about it over here circumcising Gentiles. Well, God has addressed the subject that we're not to circumcise Gentiles. But what about circumcising them? Well, the writer says that to whom we gave no such commandment. We were silent about the teaching that they're distributing. And so because we were silent about the teaching that they're distributing, they're acting on their own. They don't have God's authority to do that. And the Apostle Paul said then that they were subverting souls by that teaching. What's it mean to subvert a soul? Anybody? Well, you're destroying it. Yeah. Yeah, you're causing their souls to perish is what you're doing. And so here's the judgment of God. Now we've learned from a number of passages that I've asked you to remember. In Colossians 3, verse 17, what does it say, John? That's right. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 13. 2 Timothy chapter 1, Joey, verse 13. Paul told Timothy something about a pattern. Hold to the pattern of sound words. Now, don't miss this. Those of you who are young people in the class, some of you who are older crossed this bridge before, but some of you who are younger, perhaps you've not heard arguments about this. There are those who have contended regarding the practices of the church that there really is no pattern. In fact, some have written books to that end. Members of the church made that argument. There is no pattern. Now, if you get anything at all out of our study tonight, you look at 2 Timothy 1, verse 13, where Paul told Timothy to hold fast to the pattern that I delivered to you. Now, if nothing else, you see in that that God gave a pattern. There's a pattern for that. Yes.
And verse 14 is a classic example of that, where it says Moses, which tribe Moses spoke nothing from the priesthood. That verse is a classic example of the fact that God's silence prohibits.
That's the one we want to camp on. Right. Yeah, we want to camp on that passage, and that's exactly right. God's silence prohibits. God didn't say anything about priests from the tribe of Judah, and that's the point the writer is making. When God is silent, you can't act. All right? 2 John.
A question. And then he continues on in the next few verses to point out the shortcomings, if you will, of the first law, right?
Well, that does continue.
He talks about the weakness, the unprofitableness, for the law made nothing perfect.
Yeah.
I find it curious that, admittedly, we have a law here that God himself authored, and yet it has shortcomings.
Well,
so you have to conclude that God intentionally set it up to have shortcomings for some purpose, because you can't find yourself concluding that God, fell short of doing what he wanted to do. So
yeah.
I just find it curious, and I'm asking you to comment on the fact that God created a law.
I'd be happy to comment on it. In fact, we must comment on it. Yeah. David?
The law did exactly what God wanted to do.
That's right.
It had it in mind to do. It was never meant to bring salvation.
No. Absolutely right. Yes, absolutely right. What I would encourage you to read on that, and we're going to have to look at it because you brought up the subject, we're going to have to answer the question, is in Romans chapter 7 as well as Galatians chapter 3. Does that sound familiar? Dick and Peggy and I have been studying this text just recently. But I want to begin at Romans chapter 7. In Romans chapter 7, beginning at verse 7, keep in mind that the contrast from verse 1 has to do with the instituting of a new law. And he compares it to the marriage relationship and shows that if a woman be married to another man while her husband lives, then she is an adulteress. But if she be married to another man after her husband dies, then she is no adulteress. Now the writer doesn't elaborate on the marriage relationship. It's not his point. He uses that to illustrate. how that these were related to a law, but it is now dead. And so they're free to be joined to Christ under a new covenant. Now, picking that thought up at verse 7, he says, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Now, there's your question. Is there something shortcoming about, is something bad about the law? Let's read on. He said, God forbid. Howbeit, I had not known sin except through the law, for I had not known coveting, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. Now, what does that tell us the law did? It points out what's right. It points out what's wrong. So it helps you to have a better understanding then of what sin is. Reading on, he says at verse 8, but sin, finding occasion, wrought in me through the commandment all manner of coveting. For apart from the law, sin is dead. Now you remember in the Roman letter, in the 4th chapter, verse 15, he says, where there is no law, there is no transgression. Now apart from law, sin is dead. It can't exist. But verse 9, and I was alive apart from the law once. But when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. This is an important point. Doesn't need to be all that complicated. Paul said, I was alive apart from the law once. Can you think of a point in any man's life when he's not under obligation to law? In childhood, when he's an infant, when he doesn't understand, not doesn't know, he's not obligated to keep God's law when he can't be taught God's law. Well, verse 9 continues, or verse 9 continues, but the commandment came, for when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. Now, when did he die? Spiritually. When he came old enough to understand the law and he transgressed it. Now, whether he knew the law or not is beside the point. When he was old enough to understand it and he transgressed it, he was bound by it and he died. Now, verse 10. And the commandment which was unto life. Betty, when are God's commandments even in the old law? When are they to give life? What would you have to do under the law to have life? You'd have to keep them. All of them. Now, that's the point that Paul makes in the Galatian letter in the 3rd chapter. Yeah, that's the point. You'd have to keep all of them. Now, if you'll notice in the 3rd chapter of Galatians, just to pick up the point, he says at verse 10, for as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who continueth not in all things that are written in the book of the law to do them. Now, could anybody under that Old Testament system, other than the Lord, claim that he had life because he'd never transgressed at all? Well, no, every one of them had transgressed. We'll go back to Romans 7. Let's read on. Now, let's not miss the point that we're looking for. You've introduced the question about a law that had built into it imperfections. That is, it couldn't make man perfect. What we want to see is that it wasn't the law that was imperfect. It was man that didn't keep it. Now, after man transgressed it, the law in and of itself didn't provide the things necessary to make man perfect, because now he's messed up. Now, that's where we want to go further in this 7th chapter of Romans. Let's read on. He says at verse 11, for sin, finding occasion through the commandment, beguiled me and through it slew me. You see, the law comes into play in this equation. When the law is taught, and Paul says, I was deceived. I did this. What did I do? I transgressed the law. Now I stand condemned. So the law has a part in the equation. But verse 12, so that the law, and here's our point, is holy and the commandment holy and righteous and good. There's nothing wrong with the law. It's not the law's fault. But verse 13, did then that which is good become death unto me? God forbid. But sin, that it might be shown to be sin, by working death to me through that which is good, that is, through the law. He said that through the commandment, sin might become exceeding sinful. What's Paul learning about his relationship to law? You see, when Betty Jo don't keep this law, as time progresses, before long, she's not going to keep this one. And then she's not going to keep this one. And then she's going to mess up over here and not keep this one, because she's not keeping the law of God perfectly. Now, we're talking about that Old Testament system. Now, as Betty keeps transgressing the law, what's she becoming more and more profoundly aware of? Her sin, the condition that she's in. You see, it's getting worse, and it's getting worse, and it's getting worse.
So the point is, the fault is not with the law.
No.
The people didn't keep it.
That's right.
However, back to Hebrews 7, verse 18, it says, for on the one hand, there is an annulling of the former commandment because of its weakness.
Yes. Well, we need to talk about what that was. No, no. No, no, it's not the law. Paul has said over here that there's nothing wrong with the law. The law is good, righteous, and holy. The problem is that once man transgressed it, now the law was good, but when man transgressed it, talking now about the law of Moses, the law of Moses didn't provide adequate sacrifice to again make man perfect. You see, now there's the problem. Make him complete. The problem wasn't the law. The problem was simply in the sacrificial system. It didn't provide an adequate sacrifice under the terms of the law. Now that's why it was necessary to replace the law with a new covenant that did.
And the law's inadequacy to do that is why being referenced in verse 18 when it says it's weakness.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah. Understand. Yeah. The law didn't provide an adequate sacrifice. By design. That's right.
Like I was saying earlier, you can't find yourself concluding that God fell short in
oh, no.
His
oh, yeah.
Had this law designed without the ability.
Oh, well, that's right.
In the sense, for the purpose, I guess, of contrasting the superior law, teaching us that the grace that's in Christ is the better law. And that's where the Old Testament law fell short.
Well, that's a part of it. That's not the extent of it. The beginning of that is to help us to see the sinful condition that man is in.
Right.
That's what the law serves. Yeah.
Right. Make us accept
yeah.
The new covenant with the Jews that didn't work that well.
Well, that's right. Let me make a proposal, Joey.
Isn't it a fair statement to say that man's incapable of keeping either law?
I don't want to go there. And here's why. Sometimes that question is asked, and I just basically refuse to answer it. And my reason is this. I don't want to talk about man's capability because that reflects upon God who made man. What I want to talk about is the fact. You know, folks raise the question, and it's kind of an irritating question to me, regarding Adam and Eve. If they living in the garden had not committed sin, would they have got to live there forever? I don't know. But what I do know is fact, they committed sin. And immediately upon the heels of committing sin, God began to reveal His plan of redemption, which the Bible says was an eternal plan. Now that's all I know, is the fact. Now I don't want to go there, not speaking condescending to you, but I just don't want to go there when folks ask that question because it's supposition from the get-go.
All we do know is all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God.
That's the point. That's fact.
That's the point right there, that man has not demonstrated that he can keep either law.
Properly worded.
And that's where the grace of Christ.
That's right. Properly worded. Man has not demonstrated. But the point being, we're not now talking about whether he could or not. So I just don't want to go there. He could. That's right. He demonstrated that it's possible. Fact, no man did. Now, whether he could or not is not a place I prefer to go in discussions of folk. It just becomes a useless discussion. Jesus demonstrated it. Randy?
I just thought this was a good place to put in Romans 15:4.
Well, yeah.
For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, that through perseverance and encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever eaten a meal where you had about four meats on the table, you had about eight different pieces of vegetables, different types and kinds, and then you had about six desserts over here? Pie. Yeah. You ever been there, Daniel? Have you ever been able to eat all of it and digest it without getting sick? All of it. I'm talking to the wrong fellow, aren't I? Randy, have you ever been able to eat that without getting sick? No. Now, well, I said that for a reason. Sometimes we get several things going in our discussion and we lose sight of where we're going over here. I want to answer Joey's question. That's a good point. But let's get back to Joey's question before we leave this text. The question is the purpose of the law and whether the law had any built into it imperfections. We want to identify the purpose of the law. Let's go back to Romans 7 and pick up where we left off. In verse 13, he said, "Did that which is good become death unto me? God forbid. But sin, that it might be shown to be sin, by working death to me through that which is good, that through the commandment, sin might become exceeding sinful." And that gets us back to the illustration of Betty. The point of the law is to help folks understand how bad sin is and how bad their condition is under that system. Verse 14 says, "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin." You remember our discussion in the lesson, the sermon a few weeks ago on the spiritual man and the carnal man? And we noted that the spiritual man is the man who wants to do what's right and he surrenders to what's right. But the carnal man is the man who has trouble with this because he often examines what God has said by man's standard. That creates a problem. Now Paul said, "I know that the law is good, but the law is spiritual. But I'm carnal." You see, I got these problems where I want to reason and debate what God said. Now if you'll look at verse 15, "For that which I do, I know not. For not what I would, that do I practice. But what I hate, that I do. But if what I would not, that I do, I consent unto the law that it is good. So now it is no more I that do it, but sin which dwelleth in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but to do that which is good is not. For the good which I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I practice. But if what I would not, that I do, it is no more I that do it, but sin which dwelleth in me." Now, did you follow through all of that? I did that on purpose. But what we want to see in that is a very simple point. Paul says, "I know what's right, but I don't do it." Now, where does that come from? I know what's right, but I don't always do what's right. Now, sometimes I do things that are wrong, and I know they're wrong. Now, why do I do that? You ever ask yourself that question? You ever beat yourself up, John, because you did something wrong? You say, "I knew better than that. Why in the world did I ever do that?" Why, we all have. And that's exactly what Paul's saying here. I know what's right, but I don't always do what's right. The things that I would, I do not. But the things that I do, I don't know where that came from. Now why? Pardon me? Devil made me do it. Well, not really. The devil put the temptation there, but it didn't have to do it. You see, the problem's in me.
It's a struggle between the wills.
Yes. That's right. That's right. You see, I've got this carnal man over here, and then I've got this spiritual man over here, and a part of me wants to do what's right, and a part of me just literally don't care. Now there's the problem. Do what I want to.
If it wasn't set up that way, you wouldn't have a choice.
That's right.
So that's the whole point.
That goes back to Adam and Eve in the garden, you see. We've all been there, done that. Know what's right, but I don't do it. The things that I don't want to do, well, eventually I wind up doing that. Now, look at his question. As you drop down into this, it explains, Joey, what you were talking about. He says, beginning at verse 20, he said, "But if what I would not, that I do, it is no more I that do it, but sin which dwelleth in me." Now look at that carefully. Sin dwells in me. Now it's one thing for you to visit my house, Joey, but it's another thing for you to move in. Now we occasionally commit sin, but when we dwell there, it's one thing to take a step into the mud, but when you get in it in both feet and just stomp around and lay in it, now that's a whole other thing. So Paul said, "I've got a problem with sin. Sin wants to dwell. It wants to put in housekeeping in my life." And there's the problem. He says in verse 21, "I find then the law that to me who would do good, evil is present. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man, but I see a different law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity under the law of sin which is in my members." You see, we want to reason according to the flesh, but at the same time, we want to reason according to the Spirit. Now that won't work. Yeah. That's right. Now verse 24, look at the condition. "Wretched man that I am, who should deliver me out of the body of this death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then indeed I myself with the mind serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. Now, we presented this conflict, and we've shown what sin or what the law does. It shows sin to be exceeding sinful. Now, going back to your question, the problem with the law. Let's go to Galatians chapter 3 once again. I want to pick up the reading at verse 14. No, verse 13. We're going to read this quickly because of time. But verse 13 beginning. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having then become a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is every one that hangeth on a tree, that upon the Gentiles might come the blessings of Abraham in Christ Jesus, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. We've talked, Dick and Peggy, about the promise extensively in this passage, and we noted that to Abraham it was said, in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed, and that blessing was the blessing of salvation. That was the promise of the Spirit that was to be upon both Jews and Gentiles. And if you'll notice at verse 15, brethren, I speak after the manner of men, though it be but a man's covenant. Yet when it's been confirmed, no one maketh it void or addeth thereto. Now notice that principle. Once a man's covenant has been sealed, you don't change it. Verse 16, now to Abraham were the promises, notice plural, spoken unto his seed. He saith not unto seeds, plural, as of many, but as of one, unto thy seed, which is Christ. This promise was to come through the seed of Abraham, through Christ. And it was to benefit both Jews and Gentiles. Now, verse 17. Now, this I say, a covenant confirmed beforehand by God, the law. Now, here's our subject. The law, which came 430 years after, does not disannul so as to make the promise of none effect. The promise is unchanged by the giving of the law. The law didn't change that. The promise was confirmed. It's the way it is. Not going to be changed. Now, verse 18. For if the inheritance is of the law, it is no more a promise, but God hath granted it to Abraham by promise. Now, here's the discussion of the seed promise, salvation in Christ, granted to both Jews and Gentiles, all families of the earth. Now, that raises the question. If the law didn't change the promise, then what was the purpose of the law? Now, that hints all around to the question you're asking. Verse 19. What then is the law? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to them whom the promise had been made. And it was ordained through angels by the hand of a mediator. Now let's talk about that. It was added because of transgressions. Who transgressed? Man, yes. The Israelites was the ones to whom the law was given. But sometimes we answer the question regarding this statement. It was added because of transgressions. To what was it added? Now think on that. No. Can't be so, Randy. Don't mean to bark at you, but it can't be so. If it was added to the promise, what's the premise Paul has already established about a covenant, even a man's covenant? Once it has been confirmed, what must be done? Verse 15. Even a man's covenant. Once it has been confirmed, can you add anything to it? Can you take anything from it? Now it tells us the law was added because of transgressions. If we say the law was added to the promise, we just voided the promise. No. No. I want to make another suggestion. To the people. It was added to the people who had the law. And who was that? You answered correctly a while ago. The nation of Israel. The law was added to the people who had the promise. It was added to the Israelites, it says, because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise had been made. And it was ordained, etc., etc. But what we want to see is the law was given to those who had the promise till the seed should come. Now, what purpose did it serve the nation of Israel who had the promise? You remember my illustration about... Pardon me? Well, that was one of the purposes which is discussed here. But one of the things I want us to see in this is the illustration that I like to use is the fireman illustration that we had when I was growing up. We had a herd of white-faced Herefords. Our neighbor over there had a bull that was not white-faced Hereford. We didn't want his bull getting in with our cows, so what did we do? How? We put a fence around them. Yeah. Keep the bull out. Now sometimes, just to elaborate, Sometimes farmers would put a ring in a bull's nose, put a log chain on it with a weight on it. They were kind of hard to keep inside the fence. And with that weight, it would keep his head down. He couldn't get his head up over the fence. He couldn't get into the neighbor's cows. Well, yeah. But let's see that the law served a purpose to keep the nation of Israel intact as a nation, because it was through them that the seed should come. Now, if you'll notice at verse 20, he says, "Now a mediator is not a mediator of one, but God is one. Is the law then against the promises," plural, "of God?" God forbid. "For if there had been a law given which could make alive," now here's your answer, "if there had been a law given which could make alive, verily righteousness would have been of the law." Well, now why not?
And now we're to the idea that it was our schoolmaster to bring us under Christ.
Hadn't got there yet. That's verse 23.
But I mean, we're leading up to
that. That's right.
The whole point of it being a schoolmaster to bring us under Christ is we learn something from the old law. We learn something valuable. And what we learn from it is that it had, again, this was my original observation, by design, on purpose, by God Himself, it had a shortcoming in that it didn't have the ability to make man redeemed from his sin.
Yeah.
It took
the blood of Christ. The blood of Christ.
So
perfect sacrifice. Yeah.
We see that the fault was not with the law, but the people.
That's right.
At the same time, the law was designed by God to teach us something.
To teach us that we're not perfect.
That
we need something better.
To teach us that it's the grace of Christ that really makes salvation possible, not a system of law that we're attempting to keep.
Well, that's right.
If you look at the law as being the mix, if you're looking at the shovel going up, and you're looking at the booster rocket that gets it off the ground.
Yeah.
Well, once it gets up so high, they disengage, fall back. They've done their purpose.
Yeah.
The shovel keeps going. But the law, when we, God, like you referred to back as soon as Adam and Eve had sinned, back in Genesis 3:15, he starts telling about their plan of salvation. The law was only one small part of it.
That's right.
A lot to that.
It was a step along the way.
It was just one step.
Yeah.
If you try to look at the law as the whole thing, you messed up. It was that.
That's right.
Step, that one stage, and then it did its purpose.
That's true. Randy, sorry, to both of you. Go ahead.
You left off in Romans 7 at the end of the chapter. But
the subject continues. Oh, it does. In fact, the subject continues through the book. It's the theme of the book.
I was just going to point out the first 11 verses of chapter 8 is a contrast of, he's just told about the indwelling of sin.
Yeah.
And then he brings in the indwelling of
Christ. Oh, that's right. That's exactly right. I want to get back further to Joey's question. I want to answer that so there's not any confusion at all in anybody's mind.
And I wasn't even so much trying to ask the question of the purpose of law. I understand the purpose
yeah.
of law. I was just attempting to point out what I think is a curious observation. Is that God created this old law with, if you will, by design, built in shortcomings for a purpose to teach something.
Well, that's right.
A curious thing.
Well, that's a common thing to talk about. Often in Bible studies and classes that I conduct individually, somebody asks the question, why do we have an Old Testament and a New Testament? Well, this is an important discussion to see that. In chapter 10 of the book of Hebrews, it tells us that the law served as a shadow of good things to come. And he continues, not the very image of the things. He says, can never with the same sacrifices year by year which they offer continually make them perfect or complete that draw nigh? Else would they not have ceased to be offered? That's a legitimate question. You offer the blood of bulls and goats, you're made perfect. Well, why would you offer them next year? But under the law, you had to offer them every year. In the latter part of the verse, he says, because the worshippers, having been once cleansed, would have had no more consciousness of sins. There's your point. He said, but in those sacrifices, there is a remembrance made of sins year by year, for it is impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. Now, I used an illustration to help me so much years ago regarding this idea of sacrifice. We're getting off our topic, I know, just a little bit, but I want to hammer this down and clench it. Suppose, Joey, Suppose you went to the bank and you borrowed quite a bit of money, and you agreed with the banker, at the end of the year, I'll pay you this back with whatever interest you charge. Okay? End of the year comes, you don't have it. So you go talk to the banker and say, Mr. Banker, I don't have it. Will you carry me for another year if I pay the interest on it, at least for another year? He says, okay. Now, you've got 1 year's interest already paid. Now you're going to have to pay another year's interest because you borrowed this money. But now next year, You go to the banker and say, I still can't pay off that principal. Will you carry me another year? You're paying interest times interest times interest times interest. What's happening to the principal over here? It's just sitting there. All right, now let's suppose, just a little further, you're paying interest on this debt, interest on this debt, but now the problem is this debt is getting compounded. The debt is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger because you keep borrowing more money and you keep paying interest and interest and interest. How long is it going to be before you're in over your head and you say, man, I'll never live long enough to get out of this mess? Now, when you're offering animal sacrifices for your sins, what's going to happen next year? You're not going to sin for a year? Is that the deal? You're never going to sin for that whole year? You will. So the principle's getting bigger, but next year you offer the blood of an animal. Same animal that you offered back then, same kind. So you do it over and over and over and over, but what happened to your sin? The principle of the debt back here. Getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You see now why that the law was a schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ. You see then why the law was added because of transgressions till the seed should come. You see now why the law served to make sin exceeding sinful.
And God is teaching us that the blood of the animals paid off the interest, but it took the blood of Christ.
That's right. That's right. That's why the animals died year after year after year, but the Hebrew writer tells us that Christ died once for all time. Now that's impressive. We need to get that. That's right. Now that helps us to see the purpose of the law and why we need a new one. And that helps us to see why that under this Old Testament system, no one could be priest from the tribe of Judah. Because that was an inferior priesthood, and we need a better one.
It also brought us up to the time when all things were right, because Christ wasn't sacrificed until everything was right.
That's right, the fullness of time. Galatians 4, verse 4. That's right. Hebrews 7. That's Hebrews 7. That's where we started with this. Beginning about verse 13 through 14. Well, what we're saying is that Jesus became the new priest. He could not be priest under that system. That's right. He had to be a priest under a new system. That's right. That's right. That's right. And that's when he established his priesthood. His blood offered now instead of the blood of an animal. Yeah. Well, come here.